of co-conspirators, which left all of his efforts only half-realized and hardly worth the excitement they raised. As a result, he was only paid a total of £6,315 and an annual pension of £360 rather than the full £20,000 on which he had been counting. He was somewhat mollified, however, by receiving a commission in the British Army as a brigadier general, which carried with it a fairly respectable salary. Washington had not given up hope of capturing Arnold. Using the Culper Ring to kidnap the traitor was out of the question. Too many of the spies were vulnerable to being known to Arnold, and they were already in enough danger. Instead, Washington commissioned several new spies to make an attempt, explicitly instructing them to bring Arnold back alive to stand trial. Working covertly with Major Henry Lee, the same Henry Lee who had spoken out against the intolerable acts of 1774, Washington devised a daring plan that would require a young officer to operate in complete secrecy and disavow any involvement of the general's part. A sergeant named John Champ volunteered to carry out a dangerous mission, the particular details of which he had learned after stepping forward. Champ was about 23 or 24 years of age. Lee recalled in his memoirs of war in the Southern Department of the United States, and, rather above the common size, full of bone and muscle, with a saturnine countenance, grave, thoughtful, and taciturn of tried courage and inflexible perseverance. In short, he was large, strong, serious, and stubborn, the perfect man for such a trying job. His mission was to desert from Lee's 2nd Partisan Corps and join the British in New York City as a defector. If he implied that he had been inspired by Arnold's actions, he stood a chance of meeting Arnold and gaining his confidence. Once ingratiated with Arnold, he was to study his routines and habits and discover the most efficient means of kidnapping him with the help of a handful of operatives in and around Manhattan. The men would then smuggle the traitor out of the city and back into American-held territory in New Jersey, where Washington could take custody of Arnold. Champ and his associates needed to be extremely careful, however, for Washington did not want to give the British any reason to believe that the Americans had simply sent in thugs to finish off Arnold as revenge. The general wrote to Lee on October 20th, "No circumstance, whatever, shall obtain my consent to his being put to death. The idea which would accompany such an event would be the ruffians had been hired to assassinate him. My aim is to make a public example of him that should be strongly impressed upon those who are employed to bring him off." The plan worked beautifully. Champ managed to successfully desert, though the extreme secrecy of the plan meant that Lee's unsuspecting men gave chase and nearly captured Champ to bring him back for punishment. Nevertheless, he made it to the shore not far from two British ships and dove into the water, swimming madly toward them. After he was taken aboard and questioned, the British brought him into the city, where General Clinton, upon interviewing him, deemed his desire to join the British genuine, introduced him to Arnold, and placed him in the force Arnold now commanded. Over the next few weeks, he formed a plan to capture Arnold during his evening walk. However, Champ never turned up on the evening of December 21st, when he was scheduled to bring an unconscious Arnold to a small boat waiting in the river. A few days later, it was learned that Arnold's unit, in which Champ was now serving as part of his cover, had been unexpectedly shipped off to Virginia the day before. What had begun as a promising attempt to purchase additional safety for the culpers by removing a dangerous enemy ended in disappointment. Small victories. Despite the clever plotting of Washington and Lee and the valiant efforts by John Champ, Benedict Arnold was still at large, which meant the Culper Ring was still at risk, and one of them was still imprisoned. The pressure was felt by every member, but the spy at the center of the ring suffered the most. Evidence of Townsend's continued anxiety and despondency through the fall and winter of 1780 and 81 showed up in the account books from his store. Whereas he had previously been quite prompt in recording his business transactions, the entries suddenly appear far more sporadic. Between November 1779 and July 1780, he updated his accounts every 3 to 5 days at first, then slowing down every 7 to 9 days. During those 8 months, he was almost predictable in his reckonings, with the exception of February and March 1780, when he twice lapsed 13 days between entries. During the summer of 1780, his entries began to have much larger spans between them. He made no entries for September, just one in October on the 7th, and then nothing again until December 2nd. The next time he seems to have cracked open his ledger after that was nearly 4 months later, March 29th, 1781. Townsend's spying activities largely ceased during the season of his withdrawal from business, but Washington took advantage of that time to shift his focus temporarily from Manhattan to the surrounding areas. Thanks in part to the reports still coming in from Woodhull on Long Island, Washington began to consider Talmadge's earlier proposals to storm certain vulnerable locations on the island. On November 21, 1780, Talmadge, now a colonel in the Continental Army, led a contingency of 80 men selected from his 2nd Dragoons, along with Caleb Brewster, who is listed as a captain in the operation, from Fairfield, Connecticut, across Long Island Sound, in whaleboats to the town of Mount Sinai, roughly 6 miles from Talmadge's native Setauket. Battling rain and high winds, they marched roughly 20 miles through the night of the 22nd, straight across the island to Mastic on the southern shore, and attacked Fort St. George on the morning of November 23rd. Constructed and fortified the previous year by staunch loyalists and named for the patron saint of England, the fort had a large stockpile of supplies and provisions, including an ample supply of hay, upon which British soldiers in the area depended to feed their livestock. After a brief fight against well-armed residents, Talmadge's men were able to seize control, destroy the stockpile, burn the hay, and take the fort's inhabitants prisoner, all while suffering only one injury on their side. The prisoners were marched back across the island to the boats that were waiting under guard, and the whole company crossed the sound again for Connecticut. Washington was pleased by the efforts and applauded Talmadge in a personal letter. Woodhull, too, sent his congratulations, writing on November 28th, "The burning the forage is agreeable to me and must hurt the enemy much." It was not a major battle from a strategic standpoint, but it delivered an important morale boost to the Patriots and provided a psychological victory over the British by proving that New York and Long Island had not been forgotten, nor were they invincible. Chapter 16, The Beginning of the End. With the death of André, the British found themselves without a spymaster at a time when such an officer was particularly important. Things were heating up in the South, especially in Virginia, where Arnold, with poor Champ in tow, had sailed with 1,500 troops in December 1780. Clinton found his attention drawn to the Chesapeake, even as the raid at Fort St. George had proved that New York could not be left unattended. A man was named to fill André's vacancy and manage intelligence for the commander of the British troops on American soil. Major Oliver DeLancey was in his early 30s, a New York City native whose family was among the earliest Jewish settlers in the American colonies. He had been educated in England, but returned home after the war began in order to organize a loyalist regiment in New York. He may not have had the same level of star appeal that André enjoyed, but he was brilliant, able, and now operating in his native territory, which gave him a distinct advantage in understanding the people, customs, and terrain. He immediately set about to reorganize the British intelligence systems, unifying codes and bringing a number of disparate and independent elements together so that information could be more easily shared, analyzed, and acted upon. The Culper Ring, in the meantime, stayed busy, if not active, in spying, as the calendar turned from 1780 to 1781. Later in the winter, Caleb Brewster captured a British boat and 8 prisoners, including 2 officers. Townsend resumed his business and reopened a shop in the city in March. Woodhull tried to persuade him to start gathering intelligence again. Townsend believed that the British had dispatched a spy of their own in New York, who was actively trying to root out the sources and paths of the Culper's information, and insisted on lying low. The matter was dropped until the end of April, when Talmadge could finally report the pending resurrection of the ring's activities, with a few adjustments made to their former routine. The plan which he, Woodhull, had consented to adopt, on certain conditions, is for him to remain, for the most part, on Long Island, and Culper Jr., whom he thinks might be engaged again, to reside constantly at New York, he wrote to Washington on the 25th. That some confidential person must of course be employed to carry dispatches, as it could cause suspicions which might lead to detection if either the Culpers should be frequently passing from New York to Setauket, etc., they being men of some considerable note. Washington preferred a more timely delivery of intelligence, but he agreed to the arrangement. The Culpers' reports were essential to the continued success of the Americans, even if they did take a few days longer to arrive. The general had learned from his earlier mistake. Vital information received a few days late was infinitely preferable to no information at all. He quickly replied to Talmadge, the great object of information you are very well acquainted with, such as arrivals, embarkations, preparations for movements, alterations of positions, situation of posts, fortifications, garrisons, strength or weakness of each, distributions and strength of corps, and in general, everything which can be interesting and important for us to know. Besides these, upon a smaller scale, which are necessary to be reported, and that whatever intelligence is communicated ought to be not in general terms, but in detail and with the greatest precision. At present, I'm anxious to know, for the reports have been very numerous, vague, and uncertain, whether another embarkation is preparing, and, if so, to what amount, and where destined, what the present force of the enemy is, particularly on Long Island, in New York, and at King's Bridge, what corps are at the latter place, how strong, and where posted exactly, and indeed what the situation, prospect, and designs of the enemy are, so far as they can be penetrated into. Washington's instructions are vast in their scope and display the extreme confidence he had in the most valuable ring to obtain precisely the breadth and depth of the intelligence he required. He takes pains in the same letter to note that he is engaging in behalf of the United States a liberal reward for the services of the Culpers, of whose fidelity and ability I entertain a high opinion. It is certainly but reasonable from patriotism and every other principle that their exertions should be proportionally great to subserve essentially the interest of the public. Despite Washington's praise, Townsend adamantly refused to put pen to paper. He had seen how Andre had been done in by the discovery of papers and plans, hard and damning evidence he could not deny, nor talk his way out of. He would be happy to convey orally whatever information he had observed, Townsend explained to Woodhull when they met in the city in early May, but the risk of trying to smuggle documents out of Manhattan was far too great. Woodhull could not deny the truth of these concerns, especially now that Oliver Delancey was asserting his authority with new ideas for uncovering plots in their midst. In his May 19th letter to Talmadge, Woodhull noted that, on the way back to Long Island from visiting Townsend, the enemy must have got some hint of me, for when passing at Brooklyn Ferry was strictly examined and told some villain supported a correspondence from this place. The letter also included intelligence Austin Rowe had obtained verbally from Townsend on his last visit to the city, but they all knew their visits could not be so frequent as to raise suspicions. Woodhull and Townsend worked exhaustively to recruit a new member for the ring who was not already under the watchful eyes of British operatives and could operate freely in Manhattan and smuggle out detailed written reports. When at New York myself, together with Culper Jr., we almost racked our invention to point out a proper person and made several attempts but failed. No person will write, Woodhull lamented. Secret 6. Deliver Yorktown to Washington. General Washington remained hopeful that the next major military engagement would be focused on retaking New York, but he was depending heavily on the French Navy, specifically the large fleet under the command of Admiral de Grasse, which was currently in the Caribbean, because the success of the mission would rely in large part upon the men, supplies, and ships that the French could provide to shore up the inadequately manned and provisioned American forces. That meant that Washington's plans were at the mercy of the French powers that be, who ordered the admiral to sail. So when word reached the general that the fleet would be sailing in August 1781 to Yorktown, Virginia, and not to New York, he was disappointed, but knew he could not afford to squander such an opportunity, especially because he had a secret weapon. By leaving a small contingency of 2,500 men north of New York and ordering another unit to fake preparations for storming Staten Island, Washington gambled that the feints would frustrate General Clinton and leave him unsure of whether or not he could afford to send reinforcements to help out Lieutenant General Charles Cornwallis, one of Britain's most esteemed and feared generals at Yorktown. Meanwhile, Washington led his troops on a miserable, sweaty summer march southward to the malarial swamps of eastern Virginia. At roughly the same time, Alan McLean, the same McLean who had harbored suspicions against Benedict Arnold in Philadelphia in 1778, had been ordered to Long Island to gather any information he could regarding the preparations of the British ships set to bring relief and presumably to meet with the agents already working there who could provide him with a fuller picture before slipping back out to rejoin Washington's troops as they made camp at Yorktown. McLean had special instructions to learn as many of the British Navy's code signals as possible, so the French fleet could decipher what the enemy ships were communicating to one another during naval engagements. It was a nearly impossible task, because ships in harbor are unlikely to use distress codes or signals for attack, so McLean was left to try any desperate or accidental manner he could devise to piece together the secret system, an ineffective, not to mention dangerous, approach. Fortunately, while on Long Island, McLean was put in contact with James Rivington. The printer and coffeehouse owner was still operating his presses and still fraternizing with the British despite the dangers to spies, and his persistence had paid off. Whether someone had left a copy in Rivington's coffeehouse or the British had commissioned him to print additional copies is not clear, but somehow he managed to procure a copy of the entire British naval codebook. Rivington passed it on to McLean, who rushed it to Washington. Both McLean and the codebook made it safely off Long Island and down to Virginia by the end of the summer, and Washington was able to transport the book to Admiral de Grasse's custody by mid-September. In French hands, it was a more effective resource than the Americans could have ever dared hope for, and its loss more devastating than the British could have imagined. The siege at Yorktown was a roaring success, thanks in no small part to de Grasse's ability to anticipate nearly every movement of the British fleet. Paralyzed by indecision for fear of leaving New York vulnerable to attack, and despite continued assurances to Cornwallis that he would send reinforcements, General Clinton failed to deliver any of the promised troops to Virginia. Trapped by both land and sea, Cornwallis was unable to muster the power to break through in either direction. He could not attack. He could not retreat. A white flag was the only option. He surrendered on October 19th. The defeat at Yorktown was an embarrassment to the entire British military and caused a tremendous spat between Clinton and Cornwallis that became a public scandal back in Britain. Cornwallis set sail on the same ship that carried Benedict Arnold and his family to London in January 1782. Once on English soil, he was able to perform some measure of damage control by speaking critically of Clinton's leadership. Clinton submitted his resignation as the commander-in-chief for North America and departed for England in mid-May. In 1783, he published a book narrating his account of the 1781 campaign in North America, in which he wrote that Cornwallis's failings ultimately led to the defeat at Yorktown. To military leaders on both sides, however, the events at Yorktown made it clear that the conflict was reaching its natural end. The Americans had stood their ground and doggedly fought for every inch of land they deemed rightfully their own. The British government was finally recognizing that superior military muscle was not enough to make the determined Patriot Army back down when they had powerful allies on their side. On March 28, 1782, word reached New York from London that the House of Commons had voted to end all the offensive strikes in the American colonies, though by no means signifying the end of the military occupation or exercises. At the same time, a more moderate prime minister was coming to power, backed by a parliament that generally opposed the war. An end to the hostility seemed inevitable, but matters were far from settled. Savannah, Charleston, and New York still remained strongholds of the British Army, and Washington was forced to decide in the critical weeks following Yorktown if he should continue to march southward and eliminate those threats before refocusing his energies and resources northward on New York. In the end, he decided to divide his forces, sending some to strengthen the beleaguered troops in the Carolinas and Georgia, but returning with the majority of his troops to the Hudson Valley, just above the city. He was sure that the British were not going to allow New York to fall without a fight. Changing the tides in New York. Unrest was erupting through the city. The pockets of Patriot dissidents who had dug in their heels and stayed during the long duration of the war now grew bolder, while Loyalists, who had been certain of coming out of the war on the winning side, felt betrayed by the crown. Broadsides began to appear posted on walls and clutched in citizens' hands. New Yorkers vented discontentment with various politicians, with the king, with the war in general. Rumors of peace negotiations between the two delegations began to trickle in via packet ships, and all wondered what the terms of peace might be. Sir Guy Carleton assumed the role of commander-in-chief from Clinton in May 1782, which only added to the feelings of uncertainty, transition, and unrest, even as the British government seemed to turn away from all interest in a continued investment in the American conflict. The British officers garrisoned in New York feared an uprising from within by emboldened patriots almost as much as they feared an external attack from the Continental Army. Both out of desperation and as a show of power, the British military began enacting impressment measures around the city, pulling civilians out of their ordinary lives to serve in temporary guard duties for king and country, as Carleton's tight command of the city made Clinton's authority seem paltry. Woodhull remarked on the trend when he wrote to Talmadge, July 5th. Their design appears only to act on the defensive and be as little expense to the crown as possible. God grant their time may be short, for we have much reason to fear within their lines that Carleton's finger will be heavier than Clinton's thigh. Carleton's called a tyrant at New York by the inhabitants in general and makes them do soldiers' duty in city without distinction. The first gentleman in the city stands at officers' doors soldier-like. Robert Townsend may have been one of the unwilling temporary recruits. Family tradition held that years after, a British uniform was found stored with his belongings. When questioned about it, he reluctantly spoke of having been impressed into standing watch at the officers' headquarters in New York. In July 1782, the British left Savannah. There was no doubt that the war would soon be officially over, with the Americans emerging victorious. All but the most ardent and desperate Tories recognized that only the formal terms of a peace treaty needed to be established before the remaining enemies would be forced to leave the soil of the sovereign, independent United States of America. Loyalists now had a difficult choice to make. Did they stay and rebuild their lives, or did they emigrate back to Europe or northward to Canada? There was some hope at first that any lands and property formerly in Tory hands would be returned if it had been seized during the war, but most people recognized that such a measure would be difficult to carry out, and in some cases may actually pose a threat to the new nation, especially if large tracts of acreage ended up back in the hands of those who remained loyal to the king and wished to revive past hostilities. Besides, the reason was, to the victors go the spoils, even if that seems unfortunate and unjust. The majority of loyalists, like the majority of patriots and the revolutionary agnostics, were humble men and women of modest means. Small landowners, tenant farmers, laborers in the cities, fishermen and longshoremen along the coasts, hunters and traders in the frontiers of the Appalachians. Any property they possessed likely had not been, nor would be, threatened by seizure. In deciding where to live out the remainder of their days, they had to take into consideration the inclinations of their neighbors and their own consciences. It would not be a pleasant thing to be forever regarded as the neighbor who fought against the government. Some of the wealthiest citizens had already booked passage back to England. Now the common folk began to do the same. Each packet ship that arrived in New York Harbor carried more news from England and less hope that King George would prevail, or those subjects who had professed fidelity to him would receive any kind of reward for their loyalty and faith in the most powerful military on earth. Townsend's last letter. As Robert Townsend rode into Westchester County, New York, he could not help but admire the beauty of the foliage and the crispness of the September air. Nearly 6 years to the day after Nathan Hale's hanging, here was another spy carrying his reports on New York directly to Benjamin Talmadge, and from Talmadge's hand, they would reach Washington. It was an unlikely meeting in several ways. Not long ago, the ride west from New York City to Westchester would have been barred by sentries and checkpoints. It was still heavily guarded. That was true. The British did not want to surrender New York until absolutely required to do so, and they knew Washington was prowling outside, ready to pounce on his first opportunity. But now one could pass more safely into American-held territory without having to traverse the same tricky no-man's land that had ensnared Andre. It was also an unlikely meeting because Townsend had firmly declined to commit anything to writing back in May, but now he could see the shaky positions of the city and knew that Washington needed the best intelligence he could offer in order to calculate the next and maybe final move of the war. Townsend shouldered the responsibility of delivering the latest report himself, figuring that at this point late in the war, with all that had already transpired, if he was arrested and tried as a spy, he would have only himself to blame. Finally, the meeting was unlikely because Townsend was carrying news that the war was nearly over. Despite the British hold on New York, the Americans were in position to secure their independence thanks in no small part to the Culper Ring. The message Townsend delivered to Talmage, with the date September 19, 1782, written across the top, is the final surviving letter from Culper Jr.'s hand. The news painted a city in upheaval, and here it is. The last packet, so far from bringing better news to the Loyalists, has indeed brought the clearest and unequivocal proofs that the independence of America is unconditionally to be acknowledged, nor will there be any conditions insisted on for those who join the King's standard. It is said that an expedition is now forming at New York, and by many conjectured to be against the French fleet, etc., at Boston. The number of British troops were embarking when I left the city on the 14th and 15th instant, but I conversed fully with one of Carleton's aides on this subject, who told me that I might depend they were bound to the West Indies or Halifax. For my own part, I have no expectation that they think of any offensive movements. The above gentleman, with whom I most intimately connected, informed me that it is now under consideration to send all the British troops to the West Indies. It is a fact that a fleet is going to Charleston to bring off that garrison. Sir Guy himself says that he thinks it not improbable that the next packet may bring orders for an evacuation of New York. A fleet is getting ready to sail for the Bay of Fundy about the 1st of October to transport a large number of refugees to that quarter. The aide above referred to informs us that he thinks it's probable he shall go there himself. Indeed, I never saw such general distress and dissatisfaction in my life as is painted in the countenance of every Tory in New York. The beef contractors had orders a few days past to cease purchasing any more for the Navy, and from the appearance of things, the whole fleet are getting ready for a movement. I am myself uncertain when the troops will leave New York, but I must confess, I rather believe, if the King's magazines can be removed, that they will leave us in this fall. Unfortunately for Washington, Townsend's prediction of a British evacuation before the end of 1782 proved a little too optimistic. In Paris, where John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, John Jay, and Henry Lawrence were representing the American government, negotiations were dragging on with no sign of resolution. Even after Charleston was abandoned to the Americans on December 14th, and South Carolina could boast its freedom from the crown, Sir Guy Carleton stayed planted firmly and stubbornly in New York, with no plans to move until ordered to by King George himself. The toll on life and property that would result from an attack on New York no longer seemed worth the risk to Washington. But he could not celebrate victory, nor could any of the citizens, until a binding treaty had been ratified and New York and America had rid herself of foreign occupation. Chapter 17, Retaking New York at Last. The year 1783 dawned full of promise. On February 3rd, the government of Great Britain formally acknowledged the independence of what were once its American colonies as the United States of America. The following day, it agreed to halt all military involvement. In April, a preliminary peace treaty was ratified, and in July, tracts of land in Canada were opened to loyalists seeking a new life, and a region was designated for former slaves who had fought for Britain. Crowded ships bound for Nova Scotia and New Brunswick sailed northward from New York Harbor, but still the British Army remained firmly and fixedly in Manhattan. North of the city, near his encampments in Newburgh, Washington was struggling to subdue a rising insurrection against the back wages owed and promises of land that had been offered to Patriot soldiers, but which Congress had failed so far to deliver. Combat may have reached an end, but the enemy still would not leave, and the daunting task of rebuilding the country while paying down the debts of war loomed as challenges still to be faced. Woodhull, meanwhile, continued to send the occasional report from Long Island. Though there was nothing of great urgency or importance anymore, the Culpers had done their duty and done it well. A note dated July 5, 1783, was accompanied by a final balance record that Woodhull submitted to Talmage at the Major's request. I only kept the most simple account that I possibly could, for fear it should betray me, but I trust it is a just one, and I do assure you I've been as frugal as I possibly could. I desire you would explain to the General the circumstances that attend this lengthy correspondence, that he may be satisfied that we have not been extravagant. Woodhull then concluded the letter in a way that clearly reflected the present optimistic mood on Long Island. wishing you health and happiness. I am your humble servant, Samuel Culper. After 5 years, 4 major plots thwarted, countless misgivings and close calls, and untold sleepless nights, the Culper correspondence came to an end. The ring had operated effectively from the very heart of the enemy's headquarters and had never been successfully infiltrated, uncovered, or unmasked, despite numerous efforts in that vein. The loss of one of the ring's members was a tragedy, but it was also remarkable that the casualties were not much higher given how close the Culpers were to the enemy in Manhattan and the daring movements and maneuvers of the agents on Long Island. While the spies had not been able to deliver Manhattan to Washington before the war's end, they had been his eyes and ears there, enabling him to beat the British even without holding the city. The Culper ring was a success. All that remained now between Washington and his spies was the settling of some small monetary debts. The larger debts, the intangible kind, that helped to protect a fledgling nation, could never be fully repaid, nor did the remaining members of the Culper ring seek out such payment. A return to an open, honest, and simple life and an independent nation founded on their native soil would be reward enough. And so they hoped and prayed and waited for the British to depart from New York, at long last, even as the aftermath of the war swirled around them. Peace rages. The British delegation finally signed the Treaty of Paris in September, and Washington's troops were at the ready to ride into Manhattan as the last redcoat left the city. Colonel Talmadge, however, was concerned for the safety of his spies, who had lived and worked as loyalists during the occupation, and might now find themselves threatened by their newly empowered patriot neighbors who had no inkling of their true sentiments and bravery. How could Townsend erase the fact that he had run a store that served British soldiers, worked for a loyalist newspaper, frequented the coffee house popular among the officers, and kept company with those who had penetrated the inner circles of the top brass in the city? To anyone on the outside, Robert Townsend had not only enjoyed a rather cushy life during the war, but also profited from it. This would hardly sit well with those who suffered the loss of life, limb, and property for the sake of American independence. And Colonel Talmadge was fearful that some vengeful patriot might come looking for his pound of flesh. He was desperate to seek out his spies and contract bodyguards to ensure their personal welfare, send them underground, create for them yet another false identity elsewhere in the city, or even spirit them out of New York for a time until passions cooled. Talmadge wrote in his memoirs of these concerns, and here it is. As little doubt could be entertained, but the peace would soon follow, I found it necessary to take some steps to ensure the safety of several persons within the enemy lines who had served us faithfully and with intelligence during the war. As some of these were considered to be of the Tory character, I suggested to General Washington the propriety of my being permitted to go to New York under the cover of a flag. This he very readily granted, and I proceeded to New York, where I was surrounded by British troops, Tories, cowboys, and traitors. The whole experience of crossing into Manhattan must have been rather surreal for Talmadge, as he enjoyed the unusual privilege of dining with General Carleton himself and noted that, by officers of the Army and Navy, I was treated with great respect and attention. He added, it was not a little amusing to see how men, Tories, and refugees, who a little before uttered nothing but the terms rebels and traitors to their king, against all the officers of the American Army, would now come around me while in New York and beg my protection against the dreaded rage of their countrymen. Despite the various distractions, bids for his attention, and his high-profile status, Talmadge was able to meet quietly and safely with Townsend and others he was seeking out to ensure their security when the British finally evacuated the city. While at New York, I saw and secured all who had been friendly to us through the war, and especially our emissaries, he wrote. Then he rode north again to Newburgh to wait for Washington's next orders. Talmadge writes, having accomplished all my business in New York, I returned again to the Army and made my report to the Commander-in-Chief. The troops now began to be impatient to return to their respective homes and for those that were destined for that purpose to take possession of the city. General Washington now dismissed the greater part of the Army in so judicious a way that no unpleasant circumstances occurred. The troops broke camp and returned home, their service completed, and their dreams for liberty realized. Only those soldiers appointed to ride into New York with Washington stayed on, eager and grateful to be part of that historic moment. Finally, back in New York, at noon on Tuesday, November 25th, 1783, coincidentally, the same date as Robert Townsend's 30th birthday, Washington rode into Manhattan, with Benjamin Talmadge among the officers at his side. A contingent rode ahead of him, scanning the streets as the last of the British officers boarded their ships. Washington followed with his officers and troops spanning eight across. In the previous days and hours leading up to that moment, some joyful patriots had hoisted American flags over their homes only to have them torn down. In a few cases, they came to blows with the redcoat enforcers. But now, the citizens of New York, no longer subject to British law or British soldiers, waved flags freely as Washington rode forward. Church bells tolled, not in warning, but in celebration, and the shouts after each firing of the cannons was triumphant rather than terrified. Some people even crowded at the water's edge, waving at the ships set for departure and laughingly bidding the defeated soldiers on board a lovely trip home. So perfect was the order of march, the entire tranquility prevailed, and nothing occurred to mar the general joy, Talmadge wrote. Every countenance seemed to express the triumph of Republican principles over the military despotism which had so long pervaded this now happy city. Most of the refugees had embarked for Nova Scotia, and the few that remained were too insignificant to be noticed in the crowd. It was indeed a joyful day to the officers and soldiers of our army, and to all the friends of American independence. While the troops of the enemy still in our waters, and the host of Tories and refugees were sorely mortified, the joy of meeting friends who had long been separated by the cruel rigors of war cannot be described. The next 9 days were filled with celebrations and visitations as Washington toured the city. As his step-grandson, George Washington Parr Custis, would later record, the general even made a special stop at the shop of James Rivington, much to the surprise of many of the officers in their company, who considered Rivington a loyalist scoundrel whose continued presence in the newly freed New York seemed an affront to all patriots. But Washington seemed purposeful, even determined, as he excused himself to speak privately with Rivington about, so he claimed, certain books that the printer intended to order from London. The two men disappeared briefly, then came back to the front room where Washington prepared to take his leave. Your Excellency may rely upon my especial attention being given to the agricultural works, Rivington said, as he escorted the party to the door, voicing the sentiments most dear to the tired general's heart at the moment, which, on their arrival, will be immediately forwarded to Mount Vernon, where I trust they will contribute to your gratification amid the shades of domestic retirement. At noon on December 4th, Washington met with his officers in Francis Tavern, just a few blocks from Rivington's establishment and the fly market where Robert Townsend had operated his shop and carried out his spying duties. The time now drew near when the commander-in-chief intended to leave this part of the country for his beloved retreat at Mount Vernon. Talmadge recorded in his memoirs that it was made known to the officers then in New York that General Washington intended to commence his journey on that day. Entering the room promptly at 12 o'clock, Washington seated himself and enjoyed a light lunch before raising his glass of wine. Speaking in a voice heavy with emotion, he told them, "With a heart full of love and gratitude, I now take leave of you. I most devoutly wish that your latter days may be as prosperous and happy as your former ones have been, glorious and honorable." Following the toast, Washington paused before adding, "I shall feel obliged if each of you will come and take me by hand." One by one, the officers silently came forward to embrace their general. The simple thought that we were about to part from the man who had been conducting us through a long and bloody war, and that we should see his face no more in the world, seemed to me utterly insupportable, Talmadge wrote. A solemn procession marched Washington to the docks, where he would begin his journey home to Virginia. He was a tired man, who earnestly believed his life of public service was over, and the next generation would be those called upon to lead the country through the coming years. Talmadge narrated the scene with a note of finality. We all followed in mournful silence to the wharf, where a prodigious crowd had assembled to witness the departure of the man who under God had been the great agent in establishing the glory and independence of these United States. As soon as he was seated, the barge put off into the river, and when out in the stream, our great and beloved general waved his hat and bid us a silent adieu. We the People. Not long after General Washington's departure for civilian life, his brothers-in-arms followed suit. In a few days, Talmadge recorded, all the officers who had assembled in New York to participate in the foregoing heart-rending scene departed to their several places of abode to commence anew their avocations for life. They could at long last enjoy the future for which they had all so gallantly fought. Talmadge, too, returned to a memorable homecoming celebration he described in rather poetic terms in his memoirs. Having for 7 years been banished from the home of my father at Brookhaven, Suffolk County on Long Island, I determined to visit the place of my nativity. Being principally Whigs and now emancipated from their severe bondage, the people had determined that they would celebrate the occasion by some public demonstrations of their joy. They were therefore concluded to have public notice given that on a day near at hand, they would have an ox roasted whole in the public green to partake, of which all were invited to attend. I remember well that after a most joyful meeting with my former friends, many of whom I had not seen since the war commenced, I was appointed master of ceremonies for the occasion. When the ox was well roasted, the noble animal on his spit was removed to a proper place, and after a blessing from the god of battles had been invoked by my honored father, I began to carve, dissect, and distribute to the multitude around me. The aged and the young, the male and the female, rejoiced to receive a portion, which from the novelty of the scene and being in commemoration of so great an event, obtained a particular zest. All was harmony, for all seemed to be of one mind. A Tory could not have lived in that atmosphere 1 minute. The joy of the Whig population through the island was literally unbounded. Talmadge then set out to ride eastward across Long Island to visit friends, including perhaps the Townsends in Oyster Bay, and survey the land. As he rode from town to town, he was quite delighted to find the patriotic fervor had not been lost by those citizens who had endured much suffering under the rule of the British and the political dominance of the Loyalists. Private hospitality and public honor was most liberally bestowed on any man who had served in the Revolutionary Army. As picturesque as Talmadge's transition back to civilian life was, his former commander, George Washington, would not have longed to enjoy his own shades of domestic retirement as James Rivington had wished for him. Despite every effort to remain out of the public eye, on April 30, 1789, Washington once again found himself in New York City, the capital of the new nation. This time, however, his hand was resting not upon his sword, but upon a Bible, as he was sworn into the office of President of the United States. He had not wanted the position and had only accepted reluctantly when he was finally persuaded that his leadership would help unify the former colonies of the infant nation that were still struggling on wobbling legs toward complete self-governance free of foreign presence or occupation. Washington also declined all other titles and honoraria other than the simple and direct address of Mr. President. A disappointing visit. The following year, Washington made a tour of Long Island to meet the people and examine the damage done to land and property during the British occupation. But he also had it in mind to privately visit with and thank the individuals who had risked so much to gather intelligence and smuggle it to him. He approached Setauket on April 22, 1790, and made a stop at the house of Captain Rowe, which was full with obliging people in it. Whether these obliging people with whom he passed several pleasant hours included the rest of the Setauket culpers, Benjamin Talmadge, Abraham Woodhull, and Caleb Brewster, or if he was even aware that he was lodging under the roof of one of those very spies he had journeyed to thank, Washington did not say. His knowledge of the ring members' true identity was, after all, quite limited by design. He had not wanted to know more than he needed to in order to protect them, and several of the members, Townsend in particular, had been insistent that Washington never learn their names. The following day, he took his leave of Rose Tavern and continued eastward, where his tour took him to Oyster Bay. His brief notes made no mention of a meeting with Robert Townsend or any member of his family, despite the senior Samuel's numerous run-ins with the law and his suffering as Colonel Simcoe's reluctant landlord. Had Washington been aware of the debt of gratitude that he owed to a certain native son of this town, his stay surely would not have been so brief. Instead, he made his visit, paid his respects to the brave citizens of the town, and rode on, having never met the man he so earnestly sought to thank. By the time the president crossed the ferry back to Manhattan at sundown on April 24th, he had completed his circuit around the part of the island wherein lived the ring of spies who had served him so faithfully and carried out their weighty task with such dedication and courage. He had sincerely hoped to have some time with the mysterious Culper Jr., who had risked his life, health, and well-being for so long, passing in and out of the lion's mouth every day, seeking to still the monarch's roar within American borders. But no matter the greetings sent the general's way and the invitations extended, Townsend never stepped out of the shadows to meet with his commander-in-chief. It was a great honor, to be sure, but not one that Townsend sought. He did not want praise or celebration. The greatest reward Washington could give him was simply a return to a quiet and unassuming life, as a man subject to no king but God. Those few who knew the Culper's secret kept it close, and all Washington could do was carry in his heart the gratitude he had for the sacrifices of his brave spies, which was no less meaningful for having been made in city streets and country backroads as on a battlefield. For these men and women, too, had given their all to establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Chapter 18, Life After the Ring. With the end of the war and the start of the American Republic, the Culpers could return to their lives as ordinary citizens. While a few were not shy about their role in the war effort and enjoyed a bit of notoriety for their daring adventures, most did what all good spies do. They carried on in obscurity as ordinary and unassuming people whose neighbors never knew they had led double lives. Their stories were packed away like pressed flowers in the pages of a book, quietly waiting undetected for years, to reward some curious reader decades later with the intricacy and beauty of their design. There were whispers, rumors, and legends, of course, but no one pursued them, happy to leave well enough alone when the desired outcome of liberty had been reached, though at a high and terrible cost. Caleb Brewster, after his years of excitement rowing back and forth across Long Island Sound in his whaleboat and engaging in hard-fought skirmishes, found that the second part of his life was much quieter than the first, though he was never far from the sea. He married Ann Lewis of Fairfield, Connecticut in 1784 and moved to a farm at Black Rock, southwest of Bridgeport, where the couple had several children. Brewster passed away at his farm on February 13, 1827, and for all his prodigious feats of bravery and skill during the war, his headstone notes his eventual rank of captain and sums up his service simply: he was a brave and active officer of the Revolution. James Rivington had a less tranquil retirement. According to George Washington Parke Custis, during the private meeting between Washington and Rivington in the bookshop, the officers in the front room could distinctly hear a bag of gold coins being handed to the bookseller for his spying services during the war. Custis, however, was not actually present for the events and had a habit of occasionally embellishing stories in accordance with his own imagination. Whether gold really changed hands during the meeting or not remains unclear, but what is certain is that Rivington and his shop received special protection in the days and weeks following the British evacuation. There would be no burning and looting as had occurred at the hands of the Sons of Liberty in 1775. Later correspondents of Washington's confidants defended Rivington against libel. He remained in New York, though his newspaper business suffered because of his reputation as a staunch enemy of his new republic. He was eventually forced to close shop, but with 8 children to support in England, several bad investments, and a personal taste for the high life, his financial situation deteriorated until he was forced to serve time in debtor's prison. He died in New York, where he had spent 36 of his 78 years of life, on July 4, 1802. Austin Rowe, like Caleb Brewster, achieved the rank of captain and carried that title proudly for the rest of his life. He and his wife, the former Catherine Jones, had 8 children. In 1798, the family moved from Setauket on the north shore of Long Island to Patchogue, almost exactly opposite on the southern shore, and opened a hotel. Unlike many of the other Culpers, Rowe enjoyed sharing stories of his spying adventures with locals and patrons at his inn. Though he was careful to protect the privacy of his fellow ring members, he passed away on November 29, 1830, at the age of 81. Benjamin Talmadge married Mary Floyd, daughter of Major General William Floyd, a signer of the Declaration of Independence. The couple moved to Connecticut, where they had 7 children. In 1792, Talmadge was appointed postmaster for the town of Litchfield. He would later serve 16 years in the House of Representatives from 1801 to 1817. Interestingly, in January 1817, one of the final matters Talmadge undertook as a congressman before leaving office was to campaign against granting a pension to the three men, John Paulding, Isaac Van Wart, and David Williams, who had first captured John Andre. According to a popular weekly circular of the time, Talmage argued that the men were hardly heroes, despite their public image, but were in fact of the class of people who passed between both armies, as often in one camp as in the other. His objections rooted in the fact that when Major Andre's boots were taken off by them, it was to search for plunder and not to detect treason. If Andre could have given to these men the amount they demanded for his release, he would never have been hung for a spy, nor in captivity. Talmage died on March 7, 1835. He was 81 years old. Robert Townsend never spoke of his service, never applied for a pension, never corrected those who assumed he had done nothing but tend his shop during the war, and never, it seems, recovered emotionally from the blow of Agent 355's capture and imprisonment. After the war, he grew even more reserved and reclusive. Dr. Peter Townsend, the son of his brother Solomon, took a particular interest in his somber, silent Uncle Robert and often asked him about his service during the war, but the older man was tight-lipped and shared very little. Townsend kept to himself, staying near his brothers and their families, but never marrying himself, though he may have fathered a child with his French-Canadian housekeeper in the years following the war. The child, a large, blonde, blue-eyed boy, who resembled all the Townsend men except the slender, dark Robert, was named Robert Townsend Jr. by his mother, Mary. There was some suspicion that another Townsend brother, the flirtatious William, the flower of the family, who happened at that time to share a house with Robert, was actually the father. But Robert, having no other children, took responsibility for the boy's education and welfare. His will includes bequests for his supposed son, several nephews, and a niece. Townsend developed strong abolitionist beliefs and staunchly opposed any type of slave ownership. Later in life, he worked on behalf of some former slaves of his father's to help them gain their freedom. The man, once known as Culper Jr., died exactly 3 years after Benjamin Talmage on March 7, 1838, at the age of 84. Abraham Woodhull married Mary Smith in 1781. He lived in Setauket for the rest of his life, where he raised three children and served in roles of authority in the Suffolk County government. He never spoke much about his role in the spy ring. Mary died before Abraham. Lydia Terry became his second wife in his final years. He passed away on January 23, 1826, and was buried in Setauket Presbyterian Church graveyard. In 1936, the Mayflower chapter of the Daughters of the American Revolution erected the following marker near his simple headstone: Friend and confidant of General Washington, head of the Long Island Secret Service during the American Revolution, he operated under the alias Samuel Culper Sr. To him and his associates have been credited a large share of the success of the Army of the Revolution. Born in Setauket, October 7, 1750, in the original Woodhull homestead, son of Richard W. and Margaret Smith, fifth generation from Richard Woodhull, the original grantee of a large portion of Brookhaven Town. He was a Presbyterian, occupying a pew of authority in the old church and doing much toward the building of the new church. He was a man of integrity, punctual and precise in his business relations. He freed his slaves long before they were legally free. He filled numerous important positions, being magistrate in Setauket many years, judge of the Court of Common Pleas, 1793 to 1799, first judge of Suffolk County, from 1799 to 1810. Agent 355, whose name and whose fate have both been lost to time, might have escaped imprisonment and gone on to live a long and happy life, or she might have passed away somewhere in the dark, disease-infested hull of HMS Jersey. When the British left New York in November 1783, they abandoned the Jersey in the harbor, with several thousand starving prisoners still on board. It is extremely difficult to learn much at all about the lives and deaths of those unlucky enough to have been captured. After the surrender of the British, the former colonists sought to piece together their shattered lives and homes. Many records were lost, destroyed, or simply filed away without any thought to their deeper significance. Thousands of individuals were missing from battlefields, prison camps, and prison ships. Thousands more were untraceable due to emigration, desertion, or simply moving west into the newly opened territories beyond the Appalachians. In the mid-19th century, as the generation who lived during the Revolution was passing away, historians made some efforts to reconstruct lists of inmates' names by interviewing survivors of the Jersey. Though quite rare, and recalled several decades after the fact, not wholly reliable, women's names do appear on some of the lists. None have yet been proved to be that of Agent 355. For generations, the only Revolutionary War spy immortalized in history books was the brave but ultimately unsuccessful Nathan Hale. Tales of the Culper Ring were relegated to local legend or mystery. Who was Culper Jr.? Learning the true identity of Washington's most consistent and valuable spy in the one city the general valued most was a pursuit undertaken by several prominent researchers who analyzed the oral traditions and followed up on hunches. Townsend was always among those considered likely contenders, but the spy could not be unmasked until the wagon full of his letters was found in 1929 and given over to the care of Morton Pennypacker, who compared the writing with that of surviving Culper letters. At last, a much more complete story of the ring could be told. The momentous discovery was made during a very dark and uncertain time in American history. The Great Depression threatened the very fabric of the nation, and all eyes were focused on the upheaval in Europe and the creeping threat in the Pacific. The United States was poised at the brink of its next great chapter and was not concerned with rewriting history. Despite Pennypacker's efforts to shine a light on these provincial heroes of Long Island, Manhattan, and coastal Connecticut, the Culpers once again sank into obscurity. But even if their story was not known across the nation, the fruits of their labor, their letters, and their lives were, and continued to be, felt from sea to shining sea in the freedoms and independence all American citizens enjoy. Epilogue. We knew the story of the Culper Ring was important. We knew it was a story whose characters and events should be standard fare in history classes across the country. But what we did not know was how relevant it still proves today within the intelligence community in the United States. In February 2012, we were granted access to CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, where we met with the agency's chief historians. Outside the building is a statue honoring Nathan Hale's courage and patriotism. Inside the building are exhibits on various spying operations of the past. But nowhere did we find homage to the Culper Ring until we sat down for our meeting. We were stunned to learn that the history of the ring is taught as part of the introductory training for new agents. Whether suggested by Washington or Talmadge or simply figured out through bravery and intelligence on their own, the methods used by these citizen spies, the dead drops, the well-crafted backstories, the compartmentalizing of intelligence, the secret encrypted code, are many of the same methods still used today by secret agents the world over. And like the courageous men and women of our modern covert services, the Culpers worked in profound secrecy. They never sought credit, never received accolades, never revealed the risks they took or the sacrifices they made to serve our country. Under the unblinking leadership of Benjamin Talmadge, Washington's Secret Six served a newborn nation against a military that was considered to be unbeatable. The observation of Major George Beckwith bears repeating. Washington did not really outfight the British. He simply outspied us. There are no statues of these brave souls whose feats should earn them a place of honor alongside the heroes of the Revolution. It is our sincere hope that Robert Townsend, Abraham Woodhull, Caleb Brewster, Austin Rowe, James Rivington, and Agent 355 will be given their rightful place in American history. Their extraordinary heroism and patriotism, unknown to their contemporaries, should not be forgotten. George Washington wouldn't have wanted it any other way. After all, he preserved their letters among his belongings, and it is because of him that we know their story. This is Brian Kilmeade. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of George Washington's Secret Six. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced and directed by John McElroy. George Washington's Secret Six is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, copyright 2013. All rights reserved. The book, George Washington's Secret Six, is available wherever Sentinel books are sold.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.